Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering, and it's Friday, and you know I love it because that means it's our week in review. We have a lot to talk about today, starting with Boston police and city officials who are reconsidering whether or not body cameras should be used by officers working overtime shifts. That comes after WBUR found that while officers collectively worked almost 9,000 hours of overtime during the so-called Straight Pride Parade, not 1 minute was captured on a body camera. Some Boston Police Department officers have been wearing body cameras full-time since June, but the program only requires officers to wear the cameras during regular shifts. Daryl Stevens, executive director of the Major City Chiefs Association, questions that policy.
I can't think of any reason why a department would not want their officers to wear the cameras if they're working an overtime assignment, unless there's battery life is a problem. You're trying to provide insight into what takes place during those encounters with citizens, and they continue to take place while they're on overtime or not.
But Boston Mayor Marty Walsh emphasized to WBUR that body cameras are still a brand new policy for the city.
Me and the commission will have to have a conversation about to see how do we handle situations like that. How do we handle parades? I mean, again, this is the first time since we instituted the program that we've kind of come across this.
In Studio 3 to talk about body cameras and so much more is Seti Warren. He's the former mayor of Newton, my former mayor, an Iraq War veteran, and currently the executive director of the Shorenstein Center on Media, Politics, and Public Policy at the Harvard Kennedy School. Seti, hello.
Hi, great to be with you.
Good to have you. And Tom Nichols, professor of national security affairs at the U.S. Naval War College in Newport, Rhode Island, and the Harvard Extension School. Tom, welcome back.
Good to be with you again.
And you, what do you think? Join the conversation on the Week in Review this week. Should Boston police wear body cameras all the time? Do you feel comfortable being recorded in your interactions with the police? You can call us, 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK, or you can tweet us, at Radio Boston. All right, let's dive in. Seti, what's your reaction as a former mayor? Do you think police should use body cameras all the time?
I do. Look, you can only just look to what happened in Fort Worth just recently to Tatiana Jefferson to see that this is important.
This is the woman shot through the window
of
her home.
Yes, yes. You can look to that example as to why we want our police to do that. In addition to that, I've heard from officers who have actually said, not all, that they actually do like them because it protects them. It shows their work. We certainly started to look at it closely before I left. I think the mayor, I'm glad the mayor's open to the idea and he's going to look at it, but yes.
So, Tom, this was kind of an internal policy decision. And I think one of the questions is this the kind of thing, yeah, this is an internal thing, yeah, it turns out this is our policy, or is this the kind of thing, given the amount of advocacy that was done to get body cameras onto the Boston police, that should have been kind of one of those public announcements that people really knew about?
Well, I think if you're going to be acting in your capacity as a police officer, I also have to remember to add, I don't speak for the Naval War College. You know, I think if you're acting in your capacity as a police officer, no matter when it is, you should be wearing a body cam. I think there's always a debate to be had about body cams in general because I think people have a tendency to believe that video always tells the truth. I think that's not always the case, but my dad and my brother were both police officers, and if I were a cop, I would want to wear one. I would be more comfortable actually having that body cam on.
Why?
Because I think, generally speaking, if you're a cop and you're doing the right thing, that while video doesn't always come with its own context, it's probably better to have it than not to have it. Because I think otherwise you then get into a he said, she said, I said, they said. I think, you know, proper training about them so that they don't go on and off, that there aren't gaps in the coverage, things like that. But I think, you know, I don't think there should be anything different about being overtime. If you are in your capacity as a police officer and you're carrying a weapon and you're representing the city, then, yeah, you should have that camera on. I don't think that should be a big deal.
So, Seti, Michael Leary, who is the head of the Boston Police Patrolmen's Association, that's the union that represents Boston officers, he wrote in their most recent union newsletter letter to members, quote, "If there was any legal way to prevent the body-worn camera program from being implemented, we would have done it yesterday. But there isn't." Leary went on, quote, "I'm convinced this program will be the most expensive, we told you so, the city has ever seen, because we all know they are not necessary," end quote. So is there enough pushback to body cameras that it's going to be impossible to get to a point where people where they're wearing them all the time? Is this sort of a negotiated outcome that keeps police some of the time not wearing them?
Well, knowing that it's a negotiation with the union, as a former mayor, thinking about all the things that I negotiated with my unions, I understand there's got to be, you know, discussions, conversations within City Hall and the police, and that should happen. That's a proper way to do it with the union. But I do think that, you know, the citizens of not just Boston, but Massachusetts and the country have an expectation that there's transparency. And you see that more and more and more as these incidents have occurred. People want to know the activity of their law enforcement officers when they're working. And that's not a bad thing. And so I think the public and the citizens are going to drive this conversation more than anything.
1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK to join the conversation. And John from Natick is ready to do so. Go ahead, John.
Hi. Yeah. So I just had a question for one of the contributors who had said earlier that, you know, quote unquote, video doesn't always tell the truth. In what ways does video not reflect the absolute and sheer kind of honest, you know, actions of people? I just kind of want him to elaborate on that.
Go ahead. That was me. I mean, I think
Tom Nichols.
I think video, you know, has to have a context. For example, if you're filming a traffic stop and all you see is the stop and you don't see a 30-minute high-speed chase before it, for example, you may reach a different judgment about whether a police officer's actions are appropriate or not. I think in general, I agree with the idea that the cameras actually protect the police as often as anyone else, because I think it does leave a record of what a police officer, whether a police officer has acted professionally and within the law and so on. But the notion that a clip of video instantly tells you everything you need to know, I think is a very dangerous idea. And I think that that's, you know, not just in police work, but in a lot of places. And I think people have a tendency to invest a lot of notion in video when I think one of the things we're learning in the information age is video needs context.
So one last thing on this before we move to the next subject. I'm really interested in the push and pull around First Amendment. So the head of police camera action team who was advocating for body cameras has basically made the argument that we actually were concerned about body cameras being worn during things like parades, because that's when you're practicing your free speech and they can be used sort of as observation. Then you get a community activist like Monica Cannon Grant, who was at the counter protest for the Straight Pride Parade. And she says, hey, without those body cameras, I'm not safe. Right. This is how we make sure that there's accountability. So how does one manage the tension between the body camera creates accountability and a sort of witness? And yet it's also surveillance. That feels like a real tension to me, Seti.
Well, first of all, I want to salute the work of Shigan Ndua, who was the leader of that effort. He did a tremendous job. I know him very, very well. He's a great leader. I would think about it in this context. There is a responsibility for any department filming anywhere not to use that against anyone, any of the footage against anyone, and use it properly. That goes for any organization that's filming people outside walking by their store, banks, I mean, any institution, particularly government institutions. So I would say, you know, and I haven't talked to Shigan about this, but I would say there is a tremendous responsibility for the government to be responsible with those images. And, you know, we're getting into this question of facial recognition. These are areas that need governance, that need oversight. So I do have we've got to be responsible there. But it should not prohibit a police officer from when they are working, having that body camera on.
Okay, I'm going to give the last word to a caller, and we're going to go on to our next subject. Ed from Marlboro. Ed, you got the last word.
All right, sweet. Thank you for having me. I just want to say, I feel the officers are deterrent with wearing the body cameras, especially in overtime situations where it's having a monitored record of them in overtime, whether they're actually performing their duty in overtime, especially with the other scandal that we had with overtime payments with Massachusetts State Police a couple years ago.
Thanks for that, Ed. So that's kind of our parting thought, that there's accountability for what you're doing in your overtime time as well. All right, so much to get to today. I want to move on. I'm going to turn our attention to Fall River, where there is a crisis of leadership after Mayor Jaisal Correa announced his leave of absence.
I'm here today to officially announce my decision to forgo my campaign for re-election as the mayor of Fall River and take a temporary absence from my responsibilities as the mayor of the city. Those duties will now be handled by the city council president.
Correa, who faces two federal indictments, will keep his title and his $119,000 annual salary. Last month, Fall River City Council had attempted to remove him from office and temporarily replace him with the council president. Joe Pereira, who supported a recall of Correa, questions whether he can now just leave and keep his salary.
Right up until a short time before his speech, there was still no indication that human resources in the city or anyone else had approved a paid leave of absence for the next 12 weeks. So without him giving up the title, without that being approved, I really don't know where we stand as of this point in time.
So, Tom, he's been embroiled in scandal for 10 months, and he has stood strong in his position. Were you surprised to see him take a step back this week?
No, but I'm really interested to know what Setti thinks about this as a former mayor.
You do have a mayor in
you know,
the room.
As a kind of true son of Massachusetts, I mean, I feel like I'm having flashbacks to James Michael Curley or something. You know, it's like, well, I'm under indictment, but, you know, I'll just step down and I'll keep collecting my salary and you can't do anything about it. I mean, it just I don't understand the context in which, you know, the mayor is under indictment and then says, well, I'll just take a break for a while and let the city council run things.
Can he do that?
Yeah, look, I mean, number one, it's a sad day for Fall River and Massachusetts. Very disappointing. I really wish the mayor would step down. He should have stepped down as this legal process began. I think it's a bridge too far when he decides to take a leave of absence. And look, as a mayor, there are hundreds of decisions that need to be made on a daily basis for the city, for the citizens, in the short and long run. There's a responsibility for a chief executive officer to be there doing that work. So I do think in the future, you know, cities need to look at Lake Fall River in certain circumstances. What's allowable for a leave of absence? I mean, my friend Pete Buttigieg, he took a leave of absence to go to the military, go to Afghanistan. That's understandable.
Mayor of South Bend.
Mayor of South Bend.
Yeah.
You know, mayors have been ill. Mayors have had to take care of family members. All those things are within the realm of doing the right thing. But this is something that's different.
Of course, there's also this question of who gets to create that accountability. I mean, there's been a struggle between Correa and the city council. The city council basically tried to push him out. But one person voted against that. Councilor Stephen Camara cast the sole vote against a motion to remove the mayor by the city council because he thought it was out of line.
This case was ill-conceived from the beginning. It's not the purview of the city council to remove the mayor. That's an action that is left to the people of Fall River or to the court system.
So, Tom, here's what's on my mind about this. I actually believe there are a lot of people of goodwill in this situation and a few who aren't. But we have an unclear situation about who gets to decide what, where the accountability lies, where the leverage is. How does democracy in a community hold up in this kind of mess?
Well, two things occur to me. One is, the one thing we haven't talked about is what's best for the citizens of Fall River here? You know, we keep saying, well, does the mayor have the right to do this? Does the city council have the right to do that? What's best for the citizens? And in my view, the mayor ought to be the person thinking about that right now, because that is, as Setti points out, he's the chief executive. This decision rests with him. The other thing that I find disturbing about this is that the mayor is almost treating being an elected chief executive like it's a union job. Like, well, we're having a dispute.
Oh, that's interesting.
You know, we're having this labor dispute, so I'm going to step back and I'm going to keep my job and then we're going to kind of straighten it. Hey, this isn't like like being sick. This is, you're under federal indictment. This isn't, you know, this isn't like you had a car accident or, you know, you had a family member die. This is a serious problem. And I think, you know, I kind of grieve a little bit that we don't think of mayors or other elected politicians as role models, as stewards, as people that will put the welfare of the city first. You know, maybe just as a general principle, I expect more from a chief executive than I do from a group of people in a council. But we haven't really talked about what's best for the city.
Yeah. So, Seti, that's another question. Stewards, the word Tom used, really resonated with me. And I guess part of my question is, would it even have been possible for Correa to effectively steward the community as mayor while under two separate sets of indictments? Well, is that even
doable? Well, that's right. I mean, this is why I said a few minutes ago it would have been in the best interest of Fall River if he had actually stepped down.
Can't do the job?
Exactly. I mean, look, I know what it takes to actually run a city. You throw your life into it and you put the city first when you're making difficult decisions. And in order to sit down with a city councilor, in order to sit down with someone that you work for, the residents of that city, you have to have a certain amount of credibility. When you look in their eye, you're telling them where you think the city should be. Under these circumstances, it's not possible. And you, Tom, you're exactly right. At the end of the day, it's about the citizens of Fall River. If he's absent, if a chief executive is absent, the citizens of Fall River suffer.
Okay, we are going to take a quick break. Seti Warren, former mayor of Newton, an Iraq War veteran and currently executive director of the Shorenstein Center, stay with us. Tom Nichols, professor of national security affairs at the U.S. Naval War College in Newport, Rhode Island, also Harvard Extension School. Stick around. Listeners, I want to take a moment to let you know that this coming Tuesday, October 22nd, Radio Boston will be co-hosting a special live 90-minute debate with all 8 of the Boston City Council at Large candidates. We'd love for you to join us at WBUR City Space. For more information and free tickets, you can go to WBUR.org/events and you can sign up. We want to move on now to a roundup of what's been happening in Washington, D.C. this week. But I got to tell you, it is a lot to try to wrangle. So let's start with a little tour, starting with Syria. Here is President Trump today defending the decision to pull U.S. troops from Syria.
It was a lot of pain for a couple of days. And sometimes you have to go through some pain before you can get a good solution. But the Kurds are very happy about it. President Erdogan in Turkey is satisfied with it.
We doubt that that will satisfy Congressman Seth Moulton, who spoke to us about this yesterday.
This decision to abandon our allies, to betray the Kurds that we've been working with for years to combat ISIS, and to just suddenly pull the rug out from our troops, from under our troops, this is an unmitigated disaster.
Meanwhile, also, that meeting in which President Trump and Speaker Pelosi called each other names, and in the background, testimony in the impeachment inquiry, and not enough. Yesterday, acting White House Chief of Staff Mick Mulvaney said out loud, yep, there was a quid pro quo.
But to be clear, what you just described is a quid pro quo. It is funding will not flow unless the investigation into the Democratic server happened as well.
We do that all the time with foreign policy.
Now, just a few hours later, he took it back, saying, quote, there was absolutely no quid pro quo, end quote. Got all that? No, neither do we. But fortunately, our analysts are still with us. Maybe you guys do. So, Seti Warren, former mayor of Newton, Iraq War veteran, currently executive director of the Shorenstein Center on Media, Politics, and Public Policy at Harvard Kennedy School. Thanks for slogging it out with us on this one.
Absolutely.
And Tom Nichols, a professor of national security affairs at the U.S. Naval War College in Newport, Rhode Island, and at the Harvard Extension School. I appreciate you sticking with us.
Glad to be with you.
Okay, so let's start with Syria. The U.S. pulled troops out of northern Syria. Just days after that, Turkish forces launched a military operation in Syria intended to push the Kurdish-led groups away. The Kurds have been key U.S. allies in the fight against ISIS. Turkey sees the Kurdish fighters as connected with Kurdish terrorist groups, which have been fighting inside Turkey. Now there's this pause. Oh, my gosh. Tom, is the pause even going to last, and does any of this make sense?
No, none of it makes sense. And again, always good to point out here, I don't represent the Navy or the Naval War College. You know, the problem is that the president, people keep trying to analyze what the president's policy is here. The president has no policy. He doesn't know what he's doing. That's what it really comes down to.
This isn't secretly intentional or negotiating strategy.
Six-dimensional chess. This is Erdogan called him up and said, listen, I want this thing. And the president went, okay, you know, you're a good guy. I'm a good guy. We'll make a deal without really understanding this stuff. I mean, one of the things that we've learned about the president, he is uneducable and unbriefable. He does not listen. He does not take expert advice. He has no real advisor. So somebody gets him on the phone. They tell him they want something. He says, yes, this is a disaster. I mean, Congressman Moulton is absolutely right. And I think it's important to point out, this is a bipartisan opinion. I mean, this is not the Democrats piling on and the Republicans refusing to say anything. I mean, this is everybody who understands this situation, which is to say everyone but the president, knows that this is an unmitigated disaster that will hurt not just the Kurds in the short term, but American credibility, our alliance relations, America's honor, our word in the world. I mean, there is no silver lining here whatsoever. And one last thing, the president keeps saying things that are not true. We're not pulling troops out of Syria. We're moving them from one part of Syria to another part of Syria while we're sending another 2,000 troops to Saudi Arabia. So, you know, this notion that somehow we're kind of ejecting out of the Middle East is just wrong, but it's a great applause line, and that's what the president's about.
Okay, 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. You can join this conversation. How are you making sense of all the events in D.C. this week? Are you making sense? And has anything shifted for you in your understanding of the White House or the president's policies with these fast and furious revelations? Seti, I'm going to turn to you. Tom was talking about President's not taking troops out of Syria. He's moving troops. All right. In the meantime, we have this exchange with Nancy Pelosi and the president where they're talking about troops in Saudi Arabia. And that one's a little bit confusing. Let's listen to her talk about that.
President said, well, the reason I'm taking the troops out of Syria is because I promised in the campaign to bring the troops home. My question to him was, is Saudi Arabia home? Is Saudi Arabia home? Why are our troops going to Saudi Arabia if you promised to bring them home? He said, well, the Saudi Arabians are paying for it.
That's, of course, a deployment of 1,800 soldiers to Saudi Arabia that the Defense Department announced. As a former soldier, how do you process and react to what you just heard?
Well, there are a couple of things here, and I want to preface this by saying I agree with Tom, but number one. Number two, one of the things the president benefits from in all these discussions is that most people do not have the time to dive into foreign policy and the complexities around it. And he's conflating many different pieces of things that people believe in, bringing troops home, ending wars, with other scenarios. This scenario with Saudi Arabia. Now, just recently, it is believed by the intelligence community that Iran went in and attacked Saudi oil refineries and such, and there was a belief that there should be some response. This was a few weeks ago. And there's a belief that somehow there needed to be a strong response, right? We now have 3 weeks later, the president moving troops to Saudi Arabia, not really articulating why, but maybe it's because of the protection of Saudi Arabia through Iran, one. Two, drumming up the base by saying we're ending endless wars. At the end of the day, the American people want to understand, if we put our people in harm's way, why? Two, let's not put our people, our soldiers, our men and women in harm's way if we don't have to, based on previous events, Iraq, Vietnam. I think it's incumbent upon all of us to make sure the American people understand what's happening on the ground and why. Why is this important that we are angry and upset that Trump pulled 1,500 special operators out of Syria? One, yes, of course, we made a commitment to the Kurds, and our allies are looking at us, and they're saying, are they going to cut and run on us? That's a really serious implication. The other implication is this may embolden Russia to actually make a proactive move with our NATO allies. Putin's done that. Same thing with China and otherwise. So we may inadvertently find ourselves in a scenario where we actually have to escalate and go to war because other nation states are making moves as a result of that. So,
well, funny you should mention that, because while it was also nice that we had a mayor when we were talking about mayors, we happen to have a Russia scholar while we're talking about Russia. So, Tom, pick up the ball and keep running it down the field for us on this.
I think Vladimir Putin is one of the happiest world leaders there could be right now, because his main opponent is self-destructing faster than anyone could have possibly expected. We are now 2 years into the Trump presidency, where the president has basically said, I'm letting you off the hook for all of your attacks on the United States and on our electoral system, and I'm going to start picking fights with our own NATO allies, and I'm going to get into this bizarre situation with Turkey, a NATO ally, where they're asking us to get out of the way so that they can do something terrible, so that then we can go and sanction them and threaten them for doing the thing we told them that they were allowed to do. I mean, Putin must be sitting back and saying, look, no one make a move, no one say a word while this guy's busy hurting himself and destroying NATO. The Russians have already been emboldened. They are moving in. They are hoisting the flag over a former U.S. base. The United States has had to pull out and bomb its own base. So that the Turks, the Russians, everybody else, I mean, this is just a retreat.
The munitions,
yes.
Right?
Yeah. And we're just beating a retreat out of the region while the Russians are enlarging their presence there. And the Russians don't have to lift a finger. All they have to do is let us keep shooting ourselves in the foot.
And Sadi, what about the mercenary dimension? There's a mercenary feel to the Saudi Arabia thing, to the, hey, we're going to pull out, this is up to them. They got a lot of sand to play with. The president actually said that earlier.
It's transactional. I mean, this is how the president works. It's all transactional. It's not based on any policy. It's not based on values. It's all transactional. I also want to mention ISIS. And Tom, I don't know if you'll weigh in on that.
Right.
The result of this transactional deal that President Trump made with Erdogan and pushing the Kurds out, now we have ISIS fighters, right, that are unguarded.
And some have escaped.
Right. And so this is what the American people, this is what the people of our country need to understand as well.
We put the Kurds in the position of saying, I either have to defend my own life and the life of my family, or I have to keep guarding this prison, helping the Americans. Well, obviously, they can't do both. And we are going to create – now, the president's answer to that was, well, it doesn't matter. They're going to go to Europe, as though Europe is, you know, Mars. Once those places are open, once those prisoners are out, they're going to go a lot of places. And
we
not
are a
just,
global world.
We are a global
that's
world.
Right. Yeah.
And, you know, let's remember that, you know, a lot of the 9/11 hijackers came through Europe. So this notion that somehow they're going to go to Europe, like that's an ice flow in the middle of, you know, the Antarctic, is ridiculous. This is endangering American security at every level, from terrorism to, as Seti pointed out, you know, potentially a world war. You don't end up in a world war because somebody decides to start one. You end up in a world war because people do dumb things that lead to unforeseen consequences and complications.
Many.
All right. So speaking of unforeseen consequences and complications, I want to grab one more subject. I don't think Mick Mulvaney foresaw the consequences of what he was saying in that press conference when he said straight up, hey, there's going to be politics and foreign policy. Get over it. Yes, there was a quid pro quo. So now he's tried to back off of that. White House lawyers are saying, hey, don't look at us. We didn't have anything to do with that. How does that change the impeachment inquiry conversation this week, Seti?
I'm going to disagree with that a little bit. I mean, this is, you know, Mick Mulvaney was repeating back what his boss was saying. The strategy is let's take this illegal activity, quid pro quo, which is illegal. It is illegal to threaten to hold back aid to a foreign nation in exchange for going after a political opponent. That's illegal. It rises to the impeachment. President Trump said, yeah, I did it. Yeah. I did it. Hey, China, let's work out a deal. I mean,
right,
he's on
the
video.
South lawn of the White House.
He did.
Says it out.
All that was happening there is that his chief of staff was just repeating back the messaging points of his boss. So from my perspective, I think you're just what's happening now is you just have a collection of more video.
Okay.
For the proceedings. That's my view.
Okay, we've got just enough time left here then for our hubbubs. There's so much to get to, but I want to get to the hubbubs. Those are our brief stories that caught our attention this week. Tom, what do you got?
Well, my hubbub is the nexus of Boston and foreign policy.
Well.
Which is, welcome back, Mitt Romney. who, you know, created a reputation for himself as a mavericky kind of Republican governor.
I see what you did there.
You know, right? You know, he would buck the party, and then we lost him. He went to Utah, and he disappeared, and he became a kind of a standard issue, you know, very muted, mildly pro-Trump kind of Republican. And then he went down to the Senate floor yesterday, and he really delivered some thunder on this issue of the Kurds in Syria. So it's really nice to have the Mitt Romney that we knew in Massachusetts back on the job. I hope this time he stays.
All right. Seti, how about you? What's your hubbub?
I'm going to squeeze two quick things.
Do it.
Number one, I want to laud the city of Boston. There was a recent survey that came out that was released on Thursday that showed 86% of the respondents consider childcare unaffordable in Boston. That is huge. And for people to be able to work, women be able to work and earn a living, this is a real problem. The mayor in the city put together a program that would grow and strengthen entrepreneurs who have childcare available, have childcare programs available through training, which is a real challenge. We have a lot of workers that don't have the training to actually implement childcare, proper childcare, and through grants to grow their small business. So I just want to laud the city of Boston for addressing that, and I think people should pay more attention. The second thing I want to mention is an incredible woman that the Democratic Party lost, Marty Exiferis, passed away. She was a tireless activist for underrepresented people for decades, a leader on the South Coast and nationally in the Democratic Party, great friend, you know, worked on several presidential Democratic campaigns, and we will miss her activism and just her soul and the way she approached politics and government.
Well, our hearts go to her community and the people who loved her.
Yes.
Thanks for
yes.
remembering her here. And speaking of powerful women, for my hubbub, I'm going to give a nod to history's first all-woman spacewalk today. NASA yes. astronauts Christina Cook and Jessica Meir went outside early this morning to replace a full battery discharge charge unit at the International Space Station. I want to point out the first woman to walk in space was in 1984, so it only took another 35 years for women to go it alone. And I also want to point out that Cook was supposed to do this with another astronaut, another woman, in March, but NASA only had one woman-sized spacesuit. And they couldn't get a second one made in time, so they had to postpone it. So breaking the glass ceiling is incredible, but this is a species-level break out into the stars. I think it's very, very cool, and I want to say, NASA, welcome to the party. We women have saved you a seat. All right. Seti Warren, the former mayor of Newton, an Iraq war veteran, and currently executive director of the Shorenstein Center on Media, Politics, and Public Policy at the Harvard Kennedy School. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
And Tom Nichols, a professor of national security affairs at the U.S. Naval War College in Newport, Rhode Island, and at the Harvard Extension School. Appreciate you being with Radio Boston.
Always a pleasure.
All right. Stay with us. There is more coming up. We are going to take a look at our relationship with our dogs. We consider dogs some of our best friends and most beloved family members. But as dog cognition scientist Alexandra Horowitz explains in her latest book, Our Dogs, Ourselves, The Story of a Singular Bond, the dog-human relationship is more complex than we might think. Horowitz is head of the Dog Cognition Lab at Barnard College, Columbia University, and I'll be talking with her tomorrow at the Boston Book Festival in Copley Square. WBUR is a presenting partner there. But first, we invited her here into Studio 3 to talk about her book. She joins me now. Welcome.
I'm delighted to be here.
And we want to hear from you on this. You're welcome to call in. What do you want to know about your relationship with your dogs and how you live with them? 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALKS. So you do research with dogs. Was that because you just wanted to spend more time with them? I mean, how did you wind up picking dogs for your research?
I wish I had been that cunning. But I actually didn't anticipate that I would be studying dogs. I began as a cognitive scientist and was looking for a non-human animal to study to try to test some of my ideas about their abilities. I wound up studying animal play behavior and was looking for a subject. Yeah, and most of the subjects, most mammals play, but not always when you want them to.
Mm-hmm.
So at the time, I had a dog. I lived with a dog, and I was taking her out 3 times a day to play. And it slowly dawned on me I should be studying dogs. I studied their play for my dissertation, and it's been all dogs since.
So what are some of the key things you've learned from your research over time?
Mm. Well, I think that what the whole field of dog cognition has brought to our understanding is how skilled they are at social cognition, which is to say understanding how to solve problems using social others and understanding essentially the minds of others, which is something very important to humans and human cognition. I myself focus a lot on dogs' olfactory universe, how great they are at smelling and how that might change how they see the world.
And it turns out from your research, they're really good at smelling. Right.
I mean, we all know that dogs are good at smelling, right? I mean, that's the bomb sniffer dogs or the dogs in the airport. But I think it really drives their perception. I mean, they are living in an olfactory world the way we're living in a visual world.
So let's dive into some of the topics in your book, because there's a lot in there. And as a dog owner myself, there's a lot in there that's challenging, I think, for dog owners. You have a chapter that takes a pretty critical look at spaying and neutering dogs. Is this a movement that's gaining traction?
There is good research out there questioning the early spay-neuter policies, especially, that have become required.
Early meaning early in the dog's life?
That's right. Before 6 months of age, for instance. And that often happens at shelters where they have possession of the dogs at a young age, and before they home them, they spay and neuter them. And a lot of shelters have mandatory spay-neuter policies. Even some legislative areas do. And in this chapter, you know, I live with dogs, too, and I've always had spayed or neutered dogs. And I was told and I believed that it's the responsible thing to do. And what I'm doing in this chapter is just looking at the results of that decision for individual dog owners, but also for the dogs themselves. A lot of the research questions whether it's the best thing for them.
1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Have you spayed or neutered your dog? Do you have concerns about that practice or concerns about not employing that practice? Alexandra, it is a pretty counterintuitive approach given the standard culture around animals. What are some of the specific concerns you have, especially about spaying and neutering at an early age?
What I really wanted to open a discussion about with this chapter is whether it should be the one solution that we as a society bring to solving this problem of overpopulation, which is why there are mandatory spay-neuter policies, because in the 70s, there was a huge overpopulation problem. And millions, maybe 15, 20 million dogs a year were euthanized for no homes. The number is much smaller now for lots of reasons, including but definitely not limited to spaying and neutering. But is it right, for one thing, to make new dogs bear the responsibility of our human inability to control our dogs, right, and control population? We're making new puppies all the time. It's not that there's some dearth of puppies. There are new puppies, and yet other dogs are still being killed, euthanized, because we can't find homes for
them.
But
doesn't that then argue, yes, so then practice spaying and neutering wherever possible so that we can continue to see good results in reducing overpopulation and reducing euthanasia of pets?
Well, it might be so, right? I'm not arguing against spaying and neutering, but it has to work in hand with other changes in policy. For instance, now anyone can breed and make new dogs at any time. We can buy a new dog by the end of this segment. We could have gone online and bought 10 new puppies. If we can do that, there's no way that any amount of spaying and neutering dogs in shelters is going to solve the overpopulation problem. Second, we have to ask, you know, is it good for the dogs themselves? And there is a lot of research, especially recently by Benjamin Hart and his team at UC Davis, which looks very carefully at the results of spaying and neutering for different breeds of dogs over time. And he's seen with some breeds higher rates of cancers, much higher rates of joint disease. When you spay or neuter a dog, you're changing a lot systemically. And so we have to ask, for individual dogs, does it make sense to spay or neuter them?
All right, let's take a call. We've got Dennis from Dorchester on the line. Dennis, go ahead.
Hi, yes. You know, I just had my 10-month-old puppy neutered. And it was a Vizsla, and I had a Vizsla before that I had neutered before 6 months. And I noticed with the older dog, having just neutered the older dog, it seemed to me in the couple of weeks before he got neutered, he was more aggressive with other dogs. And I wonder if that's actually sort of old wives' tale, or if that really could be that they are more aggressive if they remain intact.
Great question for Alexandra. Let me let you answer it.
Right. Thanks for your question. It isn't really, I mean, aggression is defined in very different ways to different people. What you might be seeing is with a 10-month-old male dog is kind of teenageness, right? I mean, they're about to enter, they're entering adolescence. So you start to see a lot of behaviors, including more interest in, for instance, like mating behavior than you would have seen as with a young puppy. Is testosterone part of, you know, an adolescent's temperament? Yes, it is, right? And so when you reduce testosterone by taking out the gonads, the reproductive organs, you might see less of the behavior which we're likely to call aggressive. But when dogs are neutered for unwanted aggressive behavior, research has shown that you actually only see reduction in aggression behavior in one of four dogs.
Even afterward.
Afterward.
All right.
That's right.
Okay.
So it's not reliable.
So I want to make sure we get to a couple of the subjects in your book. So I'm going to shift gears now because, again, I have two shelter dogs. And to my chagrin as a dog owner, you take a pretty hard look at the concept of ownership and don't entirely favor it. I have to admit, Sonny and Ernie were on my lap while I was reading that chapter. And I'm like, hey, why in your mind should we think critically about this concept of owning dogs?
Yeah. And it's not that I think that we should not, that dogs should be free running around and we shouldn't have relationships with them. You know, it's because we have relationships with them that I question whether they should be owned property. I think it comes as a surprise to most people to realize that even though we consider our animals, our dogs, family members, members of our family, participants in our family who are invaluable, to the law, they are personal property. Our relationship with them is one of owner, and they're valuable. Their value is the price you paid for them. So if you have shelter dogs, that's the price you paid to get them out of the shelter. So if something were to happen to them, somebody's intentional or unintentional violence towards your dogs, the punishment would be essentially giving you the value of those dogs that you paid for them.
And what do you think should change? What's a key piece of public policy or even social practice that should change in the way we think about dog ownership?
I think the law should come more evenly with our attitudes about dogs, which is that they are sentient creatures whose well-being matters, you know, who have things that can go better or worse for them, mm-hmm. whose relationship with our family isn't like our relationship with our furniture, but is more like a relationship with other people. So there are lots of legal scholars who have different ideas about how you could change legal policy to bring those more in line.
You know, I wasn't going to say this, but something you said really struck me. So a couple years ago, our last shelter dog, who was quite old, passed away. It felt much more like grandpa had been living with us and left than that, you know, a guinea pig had been living with us and left. So there is something about the way we relate to our pets that seems quite striking.
Yeah, it is. I think they're in on all of the activities of our lives, right? That's something that sentient animals are, not objects. But the language of ownership and the laws about ownership treat them like inanimate objects.
Let's pick up another call. Susan from Berlin is on the line. Susan, what's on your mind?
Hi, I'm wondering about dogs and communication with us. I wonder how much they understand in terms of language. And also, do you think that maybe they have telepathic things? Sometimes my dog looks at me like I'm trying to tell you something, but you're not getting it. And I really wonder.
Well, that's awesome that you asked that, Susan, because, Alexandra, you actually have a chapter on talking to dogs in the book. So why don't you pick up on that?
So it is interesting because thanks for your question. We do talk a lot to dogs, but sometimes we don't really listen to them, right? I mean, we talk to them in ways that are very conversational. Do they understand that? Well, my guess is they are not understanding most of what we say in their direction. However, if you talk to them very carefully and assiduously day after day, they learn words, they can learn combinations of words, and we all know they learn sort of prosody, the sound of a sentence. Do you want to go for a walk? You know, that they learn that and they learn what happens after that. So even though they are not native language users, they can pick up on what we're saying in some level. And you might have heard of some famous language understanding dogs, Rico and Chaser, both border collies. Chaser actually just recently died. Chaser had learned 1,022 names for toys that John Pilley had taught her. And she could do different things vis-a-vis them, nose them or retrieve them. You know, I will say that John spent a couple of years speaking carefully about these toys to Chaser for up to 8 hours a day. So can they learn 1,022 words? Well, this border collie did. There's evidence of that. But we're mostly not talking to dogs like that. We're mostly just using sentences. We're talking to them about what our plans are or observing something about the environment. And they probably don't understand that.
All right. Now, I want to give our listeners a chance to hear just a little bit from the book. I want to have you read a bit from the chapter of your book, which I thought was great fun, in which you describe the scientific process you practice at home with your own dogs.
Okay, yeah, and I will set it up by saying that, you know, the scientific process is all about creating hypotheses and then revising your hypotheses with evidence and coming up with a conclusion. So since I live with dogs myself, you know, I'm always thinking up sometimes harebrained, sometimes reasonable hypotheses. So this is about one of those. Hypothesis: dog is man's best friend. So it has been said, and it seems so to this woman sitting astride two perfect dogs, one of whom once found my lost date book for me, the other of whom smiles at seeing me, both of whom have no cruelty, show reliable cheer, tolerate my peculiarities and shortcomings without judgment, and are silently eloquent. One can't help but wonder, though, as I move off the sofa to make more room for the dogs, if they are at all cunning. I do now purchase bagels specifically for the dogs, pay more for their medical care than my own, and possess pockets full of dehydrated salmon. Our family rarely travels far because we can't bring the dogs with us. We quickly scoop their seemingly precious poop and live in a constant haze of airborne dog fur. Revised hypothesis: dog is a manipulative frenemy. Since adopting a cat, I have seen that there is much overlap in cat and dog behavior, only the cat doesn't wag massively when we're home, gaze at us adoringly, and promptly respond when spoken to. Without the surfeit of crazy friendliness, it's easier to see the cat's behavior for what it is, a means to an end. Sure, she cozies up to every guest to the house, jumping on their lap and relentlessly purring and rubbing against them. But after witnessing this scene a dozen times, it began to look less like affection and more like a way to control access to the warm, soft seating locations available in the house. Now that I think about it, I notice my dog Finnegan making a noise suspiciously like purring when I rubbed his ears. Second revision: dog is a cat. Impossible. Dogs would never betray us like that. Conclusion: cats are really dogs who don't make it past the best friend qualifying rounds.
Excellent.
Thanks.
All right. We only have about 30 seconds left. What's next for you and your work?
I really want to continue to pursue some of these ideas about how we live with dogs and kind of come up with procedures for how we can live with them in the future societally and individually. We all want to do well, do the best for our dogs. You know, what can science bring to that question?
Alexander Horowitz, dog cognition scientist and author of Our Dogs, Ourselves. She's the head of the Dog Cognition Lab at Barnard College, Columbia University. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
And I'll be in conversation with Alexandra and other authors tomorrow at the Boston Book Festival in Copley Square, for which WBUR is a representing partner. You can find more information about that on our website at radioboston.org. Listeners, I also want to take a moment to let you know that next Tuesday, October 22nd, Radio Boston will be hosting a special live 90-minute debate with all 8 of the Boston City Council at-large candidates. It will be at WBUR City Space, and we'll be doing it in partnership with the Boston Globe and the McCormick Graduate School of Policy and Global Studies at UMass Boston. You can actually get free tickets. The debate will air live right here on 90.9 WBUR at 2:30 next Tuesday, but you could come. To do so, go to wbur.org/events. That's our show for today. Radio Boston is a production of 90.9 WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. I'm Tiziana Deering. Join us again next week for more Radio Boston.